This is Audible.
McMillan Audio presents Killing Patton, The Strange Death of World War II's Most Audacious General by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. This is Bill O'Reilly. George Patton is on the move, finally. Sergeant John Mims drives Patton in his signature open-air Jeep with its three-star flags over the Wheel Wells. The snows of the cruel sub-zero winter are melting at last. Patton and Mims pass the carcasses of cattle, frozen legs up as the road winds through Luxembourg and into Germany. Hulks of destroyed Sherman M4s litter the countryside. So many tanks, in fact, that Patton makes a mental note to investigate which type of enemy round defeated each of them. This is Patton's way of helping the U.S. Army build better armor for fighting the next inevitable war. It is a conflict that Patton believes will be fought soon. The Russians are moving to forcibly spread communism throughout the world, and Patton knows it. They are a scurvy race and simple savages, he writes of the Russians in his journal. We could beat the hell out of them. But that's in the future, after Germany is defeated and the cruel task of dividing Europe among the victors takes center stage. For now, it is enough the Third Army is advancing into Germany. Patton has sensed a weakness in the Wehrmacht lines and is eager to press his advantage. It was 4 weeks ago, on February 10th, when Dwight Eisenhower once again ordered Patton and his Third Army to stop their drive east and go on the defensive, and selected British Field Marshal Bernard Lord Montgomery to lead the massive Allied invasion force that will cross the strategically vital Rhine River. It is a politically astute maneuver, because while Montgomery officially reports to Eisenhower, the British Field Marshal believes himself to be, as is often portrayed in the British press, as Eisenhower's equal. Winston Churchill publicly fuels this portrayal by promoting Montgomery to Field Marshal months before Eisenhower received his fifth star, meaning that for a time Montgomery outranked the supreme commander of the Allied forces in Europe. Now, Eisenhower's decision to throw his support to Montgomery's offensive neatly diffuses any controversy that might have arisen over Eisenhower giving Patton the main thrust. Stretching 800 miles down the length of Germany from the North Sea to Switzerland, the Rhine is the last great obstacle between the Allies and the German heartland. Whoever crosses it first might also know the glory of being the first Allied general to reach Berlin. It is as if Patton's monumental achievement at Bastogne never even happened. It was rather amusing, though perhaps not flattering, to note that General Eisenhower never mentioned the Bastogne offensive, Patton writes, of his most recent discussions with Eisenhower. Then, referring to the emergency meeting in Verdun that turned the tide of the Battle of the Bulge, he adds, although this was the first time I had seen him since the 19th of December, when he seemed much pleased to have me at the critical point. Even more galling, not just to Patton, but also to the American soldiers, is that Montgomery has publicly taken credit for the Allied victory at the Battle of the Bulge. Monty insists that it is his British forces of the 21st Army Group, not American GIs, who stopped the German advance. As soon as I saw what was happening, Montgomery stated at a press conference at which he wore an outlandish purple beret, I took steps to ensure the Germans would never get over the Meuse. I carried out certain movements to meet the threatened danger. I employed the whole power of the British group of armies. What Montgomery neglected to mention was just three British divisions were made available for the battle. Of the 650,000 Allied soldiers who fought in the Battle of the Bulge, more than 600,000 were American. Once again, Bernard Law Montgomery used dishonest spin in an attempt to ensure his place in history. Montgomery's stunning January 7th press conference did considerable damage to Anglo-American relations. To Patton, it seems outrageous that Montgomery should be rewarded for such deceptive behavior. Yet despite the fact that four American soldiers now serve along the German border for every British Tommy, Eisenhower has caved in to pressure from Churchill and selected Monty to lead the charge across the Rhine. Still, the reasons for this decision are practical as well as political. The crucial Ruhr industrial region is in northern Germany, as are Montgomery's troops. Theoretically, Monty is capable of quickly laying waste to the lifeblood of Germany's war machine. Nevertheless, the decision makes George Patton furious. On this chilly Tuesday morning, The cautious and finicky Montgomery is still 10 days away from launching Operation Plunder, as the Rhine offensive is known. So Patton, sensing an immediate weakness in the German lines, has convinced Eisenhower to let him attack 200 miles to the south. The plan is to invade southern Germany's Palatinate region, and it came to Patton in a dream. It was fully formed right down to the last logistical detail. Whether ideas like this are inspiration or insomnia, I don't know, he writes in his journal. I do things by sixth sense. Patton's military ambitions for the assault are many. Among them, the devastation of all Wehrmacht troops guarding the heavily fortified Siegfried Line. Privately, however, Patton admits that not all his goals are tactical. The war is now personal. Patton has endured countless slights and setbacks. Many are of his own doing, but just as many are clearly not. Patton at heart is a simple man who wears his emotions on his sleeve. This makes him extremely poor at the sort of political posturing at which rivals such as Montgomery excel. The man who lives for battle wants to be judged by his actions, not his words. The war will end soon. Patton would love nothing more than for the spotlight to shine on his accomplishments at least one more time. Doing so at Bernard Law Montgomery's expense, of course, would make the experience all the richer. He advertises so damn much that they know where he is, Patton sneers at Montgomery, contrasting their leadership styles by alluding to the German high command's constant awareness of his rival's location. I fool them. At Patton's command, the Third Army romps through the Palatinate on what Colonel Abe Abrams of the Fourth Armored Division calls the Rhine Rat Race. They travel with ample supplies of metal decking and pontoons, allowing them to build temporary bridges across the Rhine. It is hoped well ahead of Montgomery and his 21st Army Group. American armored divisions have already succeeded in crossing the Rhine in the city of Remagen, 86 miles north of Trier. The incredulous Americans could not believe that the bridge remained intact and crossed immediately. And while they were not able to advance beyond a small toehold on the Rhine's eastern shore, the symbolism of the Allied achievement struck such fear into the minds of the Nazi high command that Adolf Hitler ordered the firing squad executions of the four officers he considered responsible for not having destroyed the bridge at Remagen. The men were forced to kneel and then were shot in the back of the neck. The final letters they had written to family and lovers were then burned. Hitler then ordered the great commando Otto Skorzeny to assemble a team of swimmers who would float down the Rhine and attach explosives to the Remagen Bridge. The mission failed when all of Skorzeny's amphibious commandos were discovered by sharp-eyed American sentries along the shore and were either killed or captured. The Allies still hold the bridge, but are unable to advance farther without the assistance of a greater fighting force. George Patton understands the significance of Remagen. 9th Armored Division of the 3rd Corps, he writes in his journal on March 7th, got a bridge intact over the Rhine at Remagen. This may have a fine influence on our future movements. I hope we get one also. But even if he can't find an intact bridge, Patton is determined to beat Montgomery across the Rhine. He has just 10 days. 2 weeks ago, the Third Army captured the ancient German fortress of Trier, attacking quickly and suffering few casualties. His victory complete, Patton now takes the opportunity to visit the conquered city. Many are convinced the Second World War will be the war to end all wars, but Patton knows better. As a reminder to himself that war is inevitable, he has been reading Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars each night before bed. The memoir recounts Caesar's battles in Gaul and Germany from 58 to 51 BC. The words rise up off the page for Patton, and he feels a personal connection to the action. As he drives to the decimated Trier, he studies the ancient highway carefully, absorbing its every nuance. It is not the sight of the swollen Moselle River that mesmerizes him, or even of the Allied engineers scurrying to corduroy the muddy country thoroughfare before Allied vehicles accidentally tumble down the steep hillside and into the raging torrent. No, it is the belief that Patton himself traveled this road 2,000 years ago. Patton is convinced that he was a soldier and a great general in his many past lives. He once stood shoulder to shoulder with Alexander the Great and Napoleon. He crossed the Alps on an elephant while residing in the body of the Carthaginian conqueror Hannibal. He once fought for the great Caesar as a Roman legionary, marching into battle on this very same road from Rostabling to Trier. Even as a biting wind chaps his exposed face, Patton could smell the coppery sweat and see the low dust clouds of legionnaires advancing on the Germanic hordes along the Moselle. Patton has no problems meshing his Protestant faith with his belief in reincarnation. He simply believes that he has a powerful connection with the supernatural. This belief was reinforced by two very prominent occurrences during World War I. On one occasion, he found himself pressed to the ground during a battle, terrified to stand and fight. He believed that he saw the faces of his dead grandfather and several uncles, demanding that he stop being a coward. The other instance took place in Langres, France, once occupied by the ancient Romans. Though he had never visited the city, Patton was able to navigate his way without the help of his French liaison officer. He gave the Frenchman a tour of the Roman ruins, including the amphitheater, parade ground, and various temples dedicated to a deity. He also drove straight to the spot where Caesar had once camped and pointed to where the Roman leader had once pitched his tent. Now, like Caesar in 57 BC, Patton has conquered Trier. Over the week it took to reduce a strategically vital city to rubble, the Germans fought tenaciously. 20 Allied bombing raids pounded the Wehrmacht defenders until it became only a matter of time before the Germans fled, and tanks from the American 10th Armored Division rolled past the ancient Roman amphitheater on the eastern edge of town. The fact that this structure remains standing while all else has crumbled is not lost on Patton. One of the few things undestroyed in Trier is the entrance to the old Roman amphitheater, which still stands in sturdy magnificence. Shortly after the conquest, on March 1st, Patton received a message from Allied headquarters. "Bypass Trier. It will take four divisions to capture it," read the order. "Have taken Trier with two divisions," an acerbic Patton responded. "What do you want me to do? Give it back?" 1 week later, Patton's plan to invade the Palatinate was approved by Eisenhower. Following the old adage that it's better to seek forgiveness than to ask permission, Patton does not plan on asking for permission to ford the Rhine should the opportunity present itself. Patton's barbed sense of humor is not accidental. He's weary of the ineffectual leadership of General Eisenhower, who, he believes, consistently sabotages his own success. He believes the same way about Omer Bradley, his immediate superior. So Bradley's February 10th order to go on the defensive was soul-crushing for Patton. He will be 60 years old this year, making him the oldest leader in age and battle experience in the United States Army in Europe, by his own estimation. The war is winding down, but it has taken its toll on George Patton. He has become so obsessed that he's now incapable of existing in a world without war. Even the total nudity of dancers at the famous Folies Bergère dance review, seen on a mid-February leave in Paris, could not distract Patton from thoughts of the fighting, nor did being recognized everywhere he went in the city, which is normally a salve for his ego. After a case of food poisoning made him violently ill and led to a growing belief that his life was being threatened by unknown forces, Patton hurried back to his headquarters near the front, unable to stay away from the war even one day longer. He knows that his last battle is soon to come, at least in this lifetime. Thus, Patton seeks to prolong his role in the fighting. "I should like to be considered for any type of combat command from a division up against the Japanese. I'm sure that my method of fighting might be successful. I'm also of such an age that this is my last war, and I would therefore like to see it through to the end," Patton writes in a letter to the Chief of Staff, General George Marshall, on March 13th. The mere thought that the fighting will soon end fills Patton with dread. "Peace is going to be hell on me," he writes to his wife Beatrice. "I will probably be a great nuisance." Patton wants to finish out the war on his own terms. That means go on the attack. "A great deal was owed to me," he wrote of one conversation with Omar Bradley, after it was suggested that the Third Army once again go on the defensive. "Unless I could continue attacking, I would have to be relieved." Dwight Eisenhower is quite confident that George Patton will never ask to be relieved. Yet he immediately follows up his February 10th order with a second command, allowing Patton to place his army on aggressive defense. Ike knows that Patton will interpret the order as permission to launch a series of low-profile attacks. Such dithering is an example of Eisenhower's greatest strength and his greatest weakness, compromise. He wants to make everyone happy and believes that public opinion wins wars. Very often it seems Eisenhower would rather make the popular decision than the right one. This is the manner in which he has behaved throughout his entire army career, and it has served him well. At the start of the war, he was a colonel, leading training exercises at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. Now his penchant for compromise and diplomacy has allowed him to rise to prominence and power, despite the glaring fact that he has never fought in a battle or even commanded troops in combat. Eisenhower personally favors a broad front assault into Germany, much like the campaigns of Hannibal at Cannae in 216 BC and General Ulysses S. Grant in the final days of the Civil War. By attacking Germany from both the north and the south, Eisenhower can effect a pincer movement, trapping the Wehrmacht between the claws of his forces. Montgomery, however, prefers a single full-blooded thrust through the industrial Ruhr region of northern Germany. Naturally, Monty plans to be in charge, bringing the full weight of 40 Allied divisions to bear on the Germans. Generals such as Patton will sit on the sidelines and watch. At first, Eisenhower privately mocked Montgomery's strategy, joking that his plan was a pencil-like thrust. But Montgomery has worn him down. Monty is enormously popular in Britain, and many British people believe it is outrageously unjust, after all their suffering, that an American now commands all ground troops in Europe. Eisenhower has appeased Britain by placing Montgomery in charge of the Rhine offensive. George Patton sees the underlying motives in Eisenhower's determination to remain popular. "Before long, Ike will be running for president," Patton tells one of his top generals. "You think I'm joking? Just wait and see." Patton will be proven correct. On November 4, 1952, Dwight Eisenhower will be elected the 34th president of the United States. On a tactical level, it's clear that Eisenhower's broad front strategy is the best possible method of attacking Germany. But in yet another example of attempting to make the popular choice, Eisenhower has temporarily discarded the strategy. Montgomery and Operation Plunder will be the focus of the Allied advance. But Montgomery's notorious caution on the battlefield, combined with the likelihood that his plan to attack through the industrial and heavily populated Ruhr region of Germany will mean bitter fighting and heavy Allied casualties, could very well spell disaster. So, Eisenhower knows he needs Patton as a backup in case the Montgomery offensive doesn't work. Thus, the war has once again become a personal competition between Patton and Montgomery, and once again Monty seems to have the advantage. Eisenhower is giving Monty and his 21st Army Group all the manpower, ammunition, gasoline, and bridging supplies they need to cross the Rhine at the northern town of Wesel and push on to Berlin, while Patton and the Third Army stay south, content with destroying the Siegfried Line. It looks like this time Montgomery will be the victor, making the decisive thrust across the Rhine and venturing the final 300 miles to Berlin and glory. "If Ike stops holding Monty's hand and gives him the supplies, I'll go through the Siegfried Line like shit through a goose," Patton has promised a British newspaper reporter. As the days tick down to Operation Plunder, Patton's army surrounds the Wehrmacht in southern Germany, capturing 60,000 prisoners and 10,000 square miles of German countryside in just 2 weeks. The Siegfried Line proves no match for the Third Army. Patton's forces are everywhere. Even in remote regions, hundreds of tanks and infantry units are seen rolling down roads long considered impassable to armor. "The enemy," notes one American soldier, "is a beaten mass of men, women, and children interspersed with diehard Nazis." Patton writes candidly to Beatrice about the condition of the German people. "I saw one woman with a perambulator full of her worldly goods sitting by it on a hill crying. An old man with a wheelbarrow and three little children wringing his hands. A woman with five children in a tin cup crying. In hundreds of villages there is not a living thing, not even a chicken. Most of the houses are heaps and stones. They brought it on themselves, but these poor peasants are not responsible." "Am I getting soft?" Patton asked Beatrice rhetorically. Predictably, Montgomery waits. The British commander is assembling the largest amphibious operation since D-Day. His staff checks and rechecks every detail, from the perceived numerical superiority of Allied forces to the number of assault boats that will be required to cross the Rhine, and even to the tonnage of munitions that the British bombers will drop on Wesel to set it ablaze, and thus root out any concealed German resistance. Meanwhile, Patton attacks. His Palatinate campaign will go down in history as one of the great strategies of the war. Even the Germans will say so, and their praise for Patton is evidence of their enormous respect for the general. "The greatest threat," a captured German officer reveals during his interrogation, "was the whereabouts of the feared U.S. Army." George Patton is always the topic of military discussion. Where is he? When will he attack? Where? How? With what? The German colonel goes on to add, General Patton is the most feared general on all fronts. The tactics of General Patton are daring and unpredictable. He is the most modern general and the best commander of armored and infantry troops combined. Patton's tanks are riding roughshod over the rugged countryside. After the staggering setback at Metz 6 months ago, Patton has shown what he's made of at Bastogne and now at the Palatinate. We are the eighth wonder of the world, Patton says of the Third Army on March 19th, congratulating himself on yet another success. And I had to beg Lion Steel to get started. Patton's forces captured the pivotal city of Koblenz at the confluence of the Rhine and the Moselle rivers. He now has eight full divisions lined up along the western shore of the Rhine, the tank barrels aimed directly at the eastern bank. All Patton needs is a place to cross. The date is March 22, 1945. 2 hours before midnight, under cover of darkness, a Third Army patrol paddles across the Rhine at Nierstein in flimsy wooden assault boats. The slap of their paddles stroking the swift waters goes unheard. They report back that no enemy troops are in the vicinity. When Patton receives the news, he immediately orders the bridging material be sent forward. By morning, hastily built pontoon bridges span the river, and an entire division of Patton's army is soon across. Patton calls Bradley, but instead of making the sort of bold pronouncement that would inform the Germans of his precise location, he sets aside his ego in a moment of caution. "Don't tell anyone, but I'm across," Patton informs Bradley. "Well, I'll be damned," Bradley responds. "You mean across the Rhine?" "Sure I am. Sneaked the division over last night. But there are so few Krauts around here, they don't know it yet. So don't make any announcement. We'll keep it secret until we see how it goes. It goes well, but only for a short time." The sight of thousands of men marching across hastily built pontoon bridges is hard to conceal. The German Air Force discovers Third Army's encroachment later that day. Disregarding Allied air superiority, the few Luftwaffe Messerschmitt fighters that have survived thus far in the war patrol low above the Rhine, searching for signs of soldiers, vehicles, and supplies. The pilots radio back what they see, then harass the intruders by dropping down a treetop level to strafe the Americans with lethal rounds of machine gun and cannon fire. But the German pilots are too bold, and in their determination to throw back Patton's invaders, all 33 Luftwaffe planes are blasted out of the sky by precision firing from Third Army's anti-aircraft guns. The German pilots are so low that bailing out and parachuting to safety is not an option. The American soldiers continue their march across the swift blue waters of the Rhine, cheered throughout the day by the sight of enemy planes exploding all across the horizon and falling into the river with a mighty splash. It is clear that the Americans no longer need to proceed under radio silence. Patton once again phones Bradley on March 23rd, eager to make history at his rival Montgomery's expense. "Brad, for God's sake, tell the world we're across," he barks into the receiver. Bradley will later remember that Patton's already high-voiced, troubled in happiness. "We knocked down 33 Krauts today when they came after our pontoon bridges. I want the world to know Third Army made it before Monty starts across." Patton's swagger only increases the next day as he takes his victorious celebration to a new level. He's driven to the front, close to where American troops pour across the Rhine at the small German town of Oppenheim. The broad icy river is dull gray, reflecting the overcast morning sky. Sergeant Mims eases Patton's jeep onto the temporary bridge, taking care to align the wheels with the wooden planks. Patton has thought carefully about how he will mark the occasion of crossing the Rhine, and he has a very special plan in mind. At the bank of the river, he orders his driver to stop. "Time out for a short halt," he tells Sergeant Mims. Patton steps out of his jeep and walks along the wooden planks to the center of the bridge. "I have been looking forward to this for some time." Walking carefully to the edge of the swaying bridge, Patton instructs Army photographers to look away. However, his aide, Charles Codman, will be allowed to take a photograph to preserve the moment for posterity. Patton unzips his fly, faces downriver, and relieves himself. "I didn't take a piss this morning when I got up, so I would have a full load," he brags as he begins to urinate. Patton looks straight into the camera lens. Upon reaching the far bank of the Rhine, Patton continues his celebration by once again stepping from his jeep and recreating William the Conqueror's arrival in England nearly 9 centuries earlier. It was William, the legendary invader from the Norman region of France, who famously fell flat on his face while leaping from his boat as it kissed the English shoreline. "See," he yells to his men, "I have taken England with both hands." Patton falls to one knee and then plants his hands deeply into the German soil. Thus, Patton cries, "William the Conqueror," in an allusion appreciated but not completely understood by many within earshot. George Patton and his Third Army are now across the Rhine and prepared to invade the German heartland, just as he did nearly 2 years ago at Messina. The ever-competitive Patton has defeated his military nemesis, British Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery. Patton will take particular pride in boasting of this accomplishment. Without benefit of aerial bombardment, ground smoke, artillery preparation, and airborne assistance. Third Army at 2200 hours, Thursday, 22nd March 1945, crossed the Rhine River. The 21st Army Group was supposed to cross the Rhine on 24th March 1945, Patton will continue, and in order to be ready for this earth-shaking event, Mr. Churchill wrote a speech congratulating Field Marshal Montgomery for the first assault crossing over the Rhine River in modern history. The speech was recorded, and through some error on the part of the British Broadcasting Corporation, was actually broadcast, in spite of the fact that the Third Army had been across the Rhine River for some 36 hours. Looking east, Patton just needs to find a way to beat the Russians into Berlin. "We are now fairly started on that phase of the campaign, which I hope will be the final one," he writes Eisenhower 2 days after crossing the Rhine. He couches his letter in respect, but his desire to remain in the fight is evident in the quiet demands of his conclusion. "I know the Third Army will be at the finish in the same decisive way that it has performed all preliminary battle," Patton reminds Eisenhower. Chapter 17, Berlin, Germany, April 1st, 1945, night. Nobody stands as Adolf Hitler enters the conference room. The Führer's entire body quivers as he assumes his usual place before the war map table. Hitler's hands shake, his head nods uncontrollably, and he's bent at the waist, too weak to stand upright. The distant thunder of Allied bombing shakes the concrete walls. Yet the Führer's eyes shine brightly behind his rimless pale green spectacles, showing no fear as he gazes down at the current location of his armies. Most of them, however, are not real, though he is too deluded to know the truth. In his desperation to end the war on his terms, Hitler imagines non-existent ghost divisions as he scrutinizes the map and pictures thousands of panzers in places where there are none at all. Meanwhile, private conversation hums as if the Führer has never even entered the first room. German officers and Hitler's secretaries gossip and chit-chat, as if the most feared man in the world were not even in their presence. An Allied bomb explodes nearby, lights sway, flickering temporarily, then return to full strength. All talk ceases. The military officers know better than to appear afraid, while the secretaries train their eyes on Hitler, waiting for his response. "That was close," Hitler says to no one in particular. Weak smiles fill the room as yet another sign of defeat enhances the awkward sense of community. Just weeks ago, such informality would have been an unforgivable lapse in protocol. But being 50 feet underground is taking its toll on Hitler's staff. They live like a cave-dwelling prehistoric Germanic tribe in a world where the walls are made of hard rock. The cement corridors are narrow, painted the color of rust, and the ceilings low. The rooms are all painted a dull gray, and the walls weep as moisture seeps through the rock. They have their own water supply thanks to a deep artesian well. A 60-kilowatt diesel generator provides energy for the switchboard, lights, and heating. The air comes from up above through a filter to ensure its purity. Yet the bunker is hardly pleasant. There are 3 separate security checkpoints just to get in, and all entrances are manned by security guards carrying machine pistols and grenades. In this way, Hitler's headquarters is, in fact, a prison. The whole atmosphere down here was debilitating, one German soldier who served in the bunker will later remember. In the long hours of the night, it could be deathly silent, except for the hum of the generator. Then there was the fetid odor of boots, sweaty woolen uniforms, acrid coal tar disinfectants. At times toward the end, when the drainage backed up, it was as pleasant as working in a public urinal. The bunker's residents can hear the air raid sirens at ground level, but rarely go up to the garden to feel the sun on their faces. The Fuhrer has banned smoking in the bunker, but breathing dank air that is fouled all too often by the Fuhrer's Mediterism is an ordeal for all. As of late, the group has become so used to the sight of their Fuhrer that even the lowest level staffers no longer feel the need to cut short their conversations when he is in their presence. Yet the informality belies the truth. Everyone, with the exception of Hitler, is terrified. He felt it up to the point of physical illness, one German officer will later write. Nothing was authentic except the fear. And yet Adolf Hitler is convinced the war can still be won. Above ground, the Allies are bombing round the clock. The American Army Air Corps in the daylight and the British Royal Air Force by night. Berlin's a city in ruins. Of its 1,562,000 homes and apartments, one-third had been completely destroyed. Almost 50,000 citizens have died, repaying the butcher's bill of the German bombings of London five times over. The people sleep most nights in the cellars or subways. Still, despite the mayhem, there's an amazing sense of routine life on the streets of Berlin. Mail is delivered each day. The Berlin Philharmonic performs at night, and the subway runs on time. Bakeries open their doors each morning, ensuring the beleaguered populace can purchase their daily brot. And despite the drone of RAF Lancaster bombers, the bars are jammed each night with Nazi bigwigs and those businessmen wealthy enough and lucky enough to have escaped military service. The gossip is always centers on the bombing, who died, who lost their homes, whose job no longer exists because their place of business has been reduced to rubble. One quiet reality, however, pervades life in Berlin. The city is mostly female. Able-bodied men have been called away to war. The Russian army is now less than 40 miles from Berlin. Refugees pouring into the capital from the east seeking to escape those brutal oppressors tell horror stories of murder and rape. They talk of a pamphlet that has been distributed to the Russian troops through Joseph Stalin's propaganda ministry, directly threatening Germans of all ages, particularly women. "Kill, kill," the leaflet reads. "Follow the precepts of Comrade Stalin. Stamp out the fascist beast once and for all in its lair. Use force and break the spirit of the Germanic women. Take them as your lawful booty. Kill. As you storm onward, kill. You gallant soldiers of the Red Army." While some wealthy Berliners are secretly making plans to flee the city and perhaps find sanctuary in Switzerland, most citizens are stuck. They cannot run, so they remain through the bombings, going about their business as best they can. The turning point of the war between the Russians and Germans took place in the city of Stalingrad. The fierce battle lasted for 5.5 months and saw the death of 1.2 million Russian soldiers and civilians and 850,000 German dead or wounded. The fighting was often in close quarters within houses and buildings of the city itself. The Germans were ruthless in their treatment of the Russian populace, murdering and raping with impunity. Eventually, the German Sixth Army was cut off from supplies. German General Friedrich von Paulus implored Hitler to let his army withdraw. The Führer refused. This resulted in 91,000 Germans being taken prisoner when the battle came to an end on February 2, 1943. Of that number, only 6,000 survived the cruelty of their Russian captors and returned home alive after the war. From then on, the Soviet army steadily advanced westward, vowing to avenge the atrocities that the German army had inflicted upon the people of Russia. The residents of Berlin will bear the brunt of this vengeance. They can only pray that the stories of rape and murder are mere rumors, but those prayers will go unanswered. On March 16th, in a special ceremony, Hitler awarded Joachim Pieper and Otto Skorzeny the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross. But his two favorite soldiers are soon to fight no more. In Vienna, Pieper and his SS Panzer Division have been defeated and disgraced in a last-ditch attempt to stop the Russian advance. Furious, Hitler has ordered that Pieper and his men remove from their uniforms the armbands bearing his name. Shortly after that, Pieper flees west and is captured by the Americans. Skorzeny, a native of Vienna, hears that the Russians are about to enter the city and races there on April 10th with a team of commandos. He finds Vienna in flames, but otherwise dark. Instantly recognizing the city will fall by morning, he and his commandos retreat. Their war is over. Skorzeny orders his men to hide themselves, while he escapes into the Alps. where he vacillates between committing suicide and fleeing Germany while he can still get out alive. Like Adolf Hitler, Skorzeny is planning a way to end the war on his terms. In time, he will surrender to the Allies. In the pale artificial light of the bunker, Adolf Hitler continues to stare, hour after hour, at his map table, waiting for some sign of hope that all will soon be well. Think of Leonidas and his 300 Spartans, he tells his personal secretary, the despicable Martin Bormann. It does not suit us to let ourselves be slaughtered like sheep. They may exterminate us, but they will not be able to lead us to the slaughter. Thus, the Fuhrer has begun a scorched earth policy designed to deprive Germany's approaching conquerors of a form of sustenance. His Nero command of March 19th states, all military, transportation, communications, industrial and food supply facilities, as well as all other resources within the Reich, which the enemy might use either immediately or in the foreseeable future for continuing the war, are to be destroyed. This is all Hitler can do. Prepare for the end. Hitler passes the time in the bunker, sleeping most days and then staying up until dawn most nights to scrutinize plans for battles that will never be fought. His palsy tremors make it impossible for him to turn the pages of a book, so he commands that his propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, read aloud to him from Robert Carlyle's biography of Frederick the Great. The 18th century Prussian warrior king was always been an inspiration to the Fuhrer. Hitler specifically chooses Carlyle's book because it was the eminent Scottish historian who set forth the great man theory of history, which states that the history of the world is but a biography of great men. Leonidas was a great man. Frederick was a great man. Hitler considers himself a great man. Reclining on the bed in his personal quarters as Goebbels sits in a nearby chair, Hitler is calmed by the words that make a vivid comparison between Frederick's times and his own situation. It is a passage describing the winter of 1761-62, when all seemed lost during the Seven Years' War. Frederick had few allies at the time, was also facing a multinational force that threatened to annihilate his Prussian troops. Hitler is now facing Armageddon. Russian troops are poised to enter his capital city. The great king did not see any way out and did not know what to do. All his generals and ministers were convinced that he was finished. The enemy already looked upon Prussia as vanquished, Goebbels reads. If there was no change by February 15th, he would give up and take poison. Goebbels pauses. Hitler is utterly silent. Then comes the advice Hitler is hoping for, delivered down through the ages from Frederick, through Carlyle. Brave king, wait but a little while. The days of your suffering will be over. Behind the clouds, the sun of your good fortune is already rising and soon will show itself to you. Goebbels closes the book. He need read no farther. Adolf Hitler, a man who believes in signs, knows that the universe is telling him not to give in. The Fuhrer begins to weep. Just days later, Hitler receives yet another sign that Germany can still win the war. He summons all his top generals and ministers to the bunker to show them the news. Here, you never wanted to believe it, he crows, distributing the report that he has just received. The bunker erupts in cheers. The news could not be more shocking. Hitler has prevailed over one of his biggest enemies. American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt is dead. Chapter 18, The Little White House, Warm Springs, Georgia, April 12, 1945, 1 p.m. The President of the United States looks defeated. Sitting placidly near the French doors of his small vacation cottage, Franklin Roosevelt is trying to appear authoritative for the artist painting his portrait. He is failing. Elizabeth Shomatoff's paintbrush moves back and forth from palette to canvas, trying to capture the 63-year-old president's image for posterity. But the task is difficult, as the president looks far older than his age. FDR is exhausted from 12 years in office and the incredible burden of World War. Still, he soldiers on. His hands shake with a feeble palsy, forcing him to press his fountain pen firmly against the documents he is trying to sign as his portrait is being drawn. Sitting in an alcove across the room, gazing adoringly at the president, is his longtime mistress, 53-year-old Lucy Mercer Rutherford. Her husband, a prominent New York socialite, nearly three decades her senior, has just died. But even while he was alive, Lucy and FDR carried on a 30-year relationship. "He deserves a good time," his cousin Alice Roosevelt once remarked of their affair. "He's married to Eleanor." It was British Prime Minister William Gladstone who said that the 11th commandment for politicians is, "Thou shalt not get caught." The affair between Lucy Mercer Rutherford and FDR adheres to that adage. Way back in 1918, Roosevelt promised his wife Eleanor that he would banish Lucy from his life, but that has not happened. Lucy is a tall, striking brunette with blue eyes and a flirtatious, fun-loving personality that is the polar opposite of Eleanor's prudish and critical one. Lucy is often by FDR's side when he travels outside Washington, and Secret Service agents clandestinely spirit her into the White House at the president's order. Roosevelt arrived here at his beloved vacation home almost 2 weeks ago. This marks the 41st time he has come to Warm Springs since taking office. When he boarded the Ferdinand Magellan for the overnight train ride from Washington down to Georgia, he was shrunken from weight loss. His face was pale, gray, from exhaustion. His heart condition has worsened since his inauguration 3 months ago. In fact, FDR's health has declined so rapidly that Vice President Harry Truman is amazed the president continues to take on so much work. Suddenly, Elizabeth sees a crimson flush filling Roosevelt's cheeks. She's been struggling all morning with ways to make the president appear more youthful and robust, and is amazed at this instant change in his skin tone. The Russian-born painter reaches for the proper shade of red to capture his new ruddy glow. What she does not know is that the president of the United States is in the early stages of a cerebral hemorrhage. Chronic hypertension, brought upon by years of smoking and lack of physical exercise, has burst an artery in his brain. The surrounding tissue in his skull is now drenched in blood. There is no way to staunch the bleeding. Roosevelt lurches, waving his right hand in the air. His left hand, like that entire side of his body, is now paralyzed. His face looks almost childish, as if the most powerful man in the world were lost and needed help finding his way. "I have a terrific pain in the back of my head," he moans. The president's eyes close. His head spills forward. FDR's trademark, that chin that so many cartoonists have drawn at a jaunty, uplifted angle, now settles atop his chest. Roosevelt is immediately carried into a small bedroom by a butler and FDR's longtime valet, Arthur Prettyman. His blood pressure soars to 300 over 190. In a scene reminiscent of the death of Abraham Lincoln, a team of doctors soon arrives and begins work feverishly to save him. They fail. At 2:15, Lucy Mercer Rutherford knows she must leave. She motions to Elizabeth Shamatov. "We must pack up and go," Lucy tells the painter. "The family will be arriving by plane, and the rooms must be vacant." She packs quickly, says goodbye to FDR one last time, and is out the door by 2:30. At 3:35 p.m., the doctors labor no more. FDR is gone. 90 minutes later in Washington, Harry Truman walks into the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn's, private office for a quiet glass of old granddad bourbon on the rocks. But Truman will have to hold off on that drink. An urgent message is waiting from the White House Press Secretary Stephen Early, asking him to come to the White House as quickly as possible. Truman leaves in such a hurry that he loses his Secret Service detail. Once at the White House, he is led upstairs to the presidential residence, then immediately into Eleanor Roosevelt's study. Hundreds of framed photographs cover the walls of the enormous room. The First Lady sits on a chair dressed in black, her face lit by the afternoon sun shining in through the two great windows. She was at a lunch, listening to a piano performance when, like Truman, she received a call asking her to return to the White House. She and her daughter Anna changed into black mourning dresses. Eleanor then broke the news by cable to the Roosevelt's four sons, who are off serving in the military. Now she must break the news to the vice president that the man to whom she had been happily and unhappily married for 40 years is dead. Truman has no idea why he has been summoned. At first, Eleanor gives nothing away. She was raised never to display emotion publicly and is outwardly calm as he steps into the room. Her black dress provides the only clue as to what she is about to say. The First Lady walks to the vice president and tenderly places a hand on his shoulder. "Harry," she informs him, "the president is dead." Truman is shocked. "I had been afraid for some weeks that something would happen to this great leader, but now that this has happened, I was unprepared for it," he will later recall. Emotional as always, Truman fights back the tears. The death of FDR is stunning, but not as much as the terrifying realization that he is now President of the United States. "Is there anything I can do for you?" Truman asked, remembering his manners. Eleanor Roosevelt looks hard at Harry Truman. "Is there anything we can do for you?" she says, "for you are the one in trouble now." 3,000 miles to the east, George Patton is just finishing his daily journal entries. The hour is late, but today has been extraordinary, and he needs to put down every last detail on paper before going to bed. Finally, he closes his journal and puts down his pen. Patton notices that his wristwatch needs winding, so he turns on the radio in a small truck trailer that serves as his field bedroom. He hopes to get the exact time from the British Broadcasting Corporation's evening broadcast. Instead, he hears the shocking news that FDR is no more. This is the wretched conclusion to what has been the most nerve-wracking day Patton has endured thus far in the war. Just after breakfast, he met with Generals Dwight Eisenhower and Omar Bradley at his headquarters in an old Wehrmacht fort in Hirschfeld, 160 miles east of the Rhine. Together, they traveled to the town of Merkers, where Patton's army has just made an incredible find. The three men entered the mouth of a massive cave, where they boarded a flimsy wooden elevator that lowered them 2,000 feet into a salt mine. The shaft was pitch black, so once the daylight above them narrowed to a pinprick during the descent, Patton could not see the other occupants of the car. Noting that the elevator was suspended from a single thin cable, he couldn't help but quip about their plight. "If that clothesline should break," he joked grimly, "promotions in the United States Army would be considerably stimulated." "George, that's enough," shot back a nervous Eisenhower. "No more cracks until we're above ground again." The purpose of their descent is of worldwide significance. Elements of Patton's Third Army accidentally discovered the Merkers mine while interrogating local citizens. The bombing of Berlin had forced the Nazis to smuggle their financial reserves out of the Reichsbank and to a place of safety. They chose this inaccessible salt mine. Literally hundreds of millions of dollars in the form of gold bars, currency, and priceless works of art were delivered 200 miles from Berlin to Merkers by train, then stored underground. As Patton, Eisenhower, and Bradley step off the darkness of the elevator and into the brightly lit cave, they find a surreal scene. Bags of gold and cash stretch as far as the eye can see. Hundreds of paintings and sculptures, including an Egyptian bust of Queen Nefertiti, line the walls, along with paintings by Titian and Manet. In its way, the gathered wealth signifies the dissolution of the Nazi government. Without money in the capital city of Berlin, it can no longer wage war. In addition to the German Reichsmarks and gold bricks, there was a great deal of French, American, and British gold currency. Also a number of suitcases filled with jewelry, such as silver and gold cigarette cases, wristwatch cases, spoons, forks, vases, gold-filled teeth, false teeth, Patton wrote in his journal. Patton suggests to Eisenhower that the gold be melted down into metal, one for every son of a bitch in the Third Army. Later in the day, Patton's mood abruptly shifts. The three generals lunch together, then go on a tour of the newly liberated concentration camp at Ohrdruf, 80 miles east of the Merkers mine. It was Patton's 4th Armored Division, the first tanks into Bastogne, and the first to reach the Rhine, that found the horrifying sight. Unlike Auschwitz, where SS guards were so rattled by the approaching Russians that they fled before executing the inmates, many residents of Ohrdruf were either shot or marched off to the Buchenwald concentration camp. Many were so emaciated and malnourished that the bullet wounds in their skulls had not even bled. Patton has seen death in many forms during his time in the military. He's seen men blown to pieces, others lose their entire faces to exploding shells. But nothing he has ever witnessed prepared him for Ohrdruf. "It was the most appalling sight imaginable," he will write in his journal. A former inmate leads the tour, showing the generals the gallows where men were hanged for trying to escape and the whipping table where beatings were administered at random. Just beyond the whipping table, Patton later wrote, it was a pile of 40 bodies, more or less naked. All of them had been shot in the back of the head at short range, and the blood was still cooling on the ground. At one point, Patton excuses himself from the tour and walks off to vomit against the side of a building. When our troops began to draw near, the Germans thought it expedient to remove the evidence of their crimes. They therefore used the inmates to exhume the recently buried bodies and to build a mammoth griddle of railway tracks laid on a brick foundation. The bodies were piled on this, and they attempted to burn them. The attempt was a giant failure. as he one could not help think of some giant cannibalistic barbecue, Patton wrote. In the pit itself are arms and legs and portions of bodies sticking out of the green water which partially filled it. Writing those words should have been the end of the day for Patton, but the sudden news about FDR's death rates another journal entry. He thought highly of Roosevelt and doubts Truman will make much of a president. Patton and Harry Truman actually fought together during World War I. Truman commanded artillery that protected his armored units in the Argonne Forest. But Patton doesn't remember this. Seems very unfortunate that in order to secure political preference, people are made vice presidents, who are intended neither for the party nor by the Lord to be presidents, he writes in his journal before turning out the lights well past midnight. 8 hours later, in the bathroom of his lavish suite at the Ritz Hotel in Paris, Wild Bill Donovan stands bare-chested shaving. He arrived from London late last night and went to bed before FDR died. Right now, he does not yet know the bad news. The spy in charge of the Office of Strategic Services last met with President Roosevelt less than a month ago, when FDR consented to give the full weight of his office to the formation of a new national spy organization. Donovan's future and that of the fledgling CIA seem to be secure. While Bill has ordered many politically motivated assassinations, to him, murder is just one of many options in fulfilling a mission. But of late, it has been just as important to pursue a policy of political gamesmanship. Donovan is good at that, and his hold on power seems to expand every day. Donovan's suite will serve as his headquarters during his time in Paris. As with his London headquarters at the equally luxurious Claridge's Hotel, here aides and secretaries will stream in and out of the suite throughout the day, bringing Donovan cables and communiques, updating the actions of his ever-growing worldwide network of spies. So it is no surprise when J. Russell Forgan, the New York banker who now serves as the OSS London counterintelligence chief, races into the bathroom while Donovan is shaving. For Donovan, the news that the president has died is nothing short of a calamity. He grabs a towel, wipes away his shaving cream, and immediately sends a condolence telegram to Eleanor. Then Wild Bill Donovan sits down at the edge of his bed. It is a bed with a history, for it was used by Hermann Göring, the head of the Luftwaffe, when he stayed in Paris during the Nazi occupation. Donovan knows this, but the Nazis are now the farthest thought from his mind. So is Franklin Roosevelt. Right now, the only thing on Wild Bill Donovan's mind is Wild Bill Donovan. His future appears in jeopardy. Without FDR to back him, his dreams of a post-war spy agency are now in peril. Half-dressed and half-shaven, Donovan rests his head in his hands. "This is the most terrible news I've ever had," he moans. 3 hours later, he finally rises from the bed. His determination has returned. Chapter 19, Houses of Parliament, London, England, April 17, 1945, 4:08 p.m. Conversation ceases as Winston Churchill rises to his feet. There is Johnny Walker Scotch whiskey on his breath, and he wears a bow tie with his three-piece suit. The rotund Prime Minister's trademark, half-smoked, well-chewed cigar, is nowhere to be seen as he stands somberly in the center aisle of Britain's ornate House of Lords debating chamber, preparing to remember his late friend Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was devastated when he received the news of FDR's death. "I felt as if I had been struck a considerable blow," Churchill will write in the Second World War, Triumph and Tragedy, the sixth volume of his war memoirs. "I was overpowered by a sense of deep and irreparable loss." Standing 5'8" and weighing nearly 300 pounds, Winston Churchill is already a mythic figure in England. He is the son of the legendary Randolph Churchill, a dynamic British statesman who died at the age of 45, never fulfilling his goal of becoming prime minister. It would be left to the eccentric Winston to fill that position, although the journey was neither short nor easy. Winston was in a self-described political wilderness for much of his career, and was considered out of touch with political reality, thanks to his criticism of Nazi Germany in the 1930s, a time when few British politicians were bothered by the rise of Adolf Hitler. Once Churchill became prime minister in May 1940, at the height of the Nazi threat, he inspired the British people with fearless radio speeches that offered them hope at a time when they had none. When the Luftwaffe bombed London, Churchill was often seen in public visiting bomb sites at great threat to his own life. Throughout his career, the one steadfast presence has been that of his wife, Clementine. They've been married for 36 years and have 5 children. It is warm in Britain this April. An excess of sunshine, in the words of one British meteorologist, now makes the air thick inside the century-old un-air-conditioned chamber. Nevertheless, the 615 elected members of Parliament are almost all in attendance, seated in rows on either side of the aisle. Churchill's Conservative Party sits to his right, the opposition Labour Party to his left. The MPs had more room to spread out before the war, but German bombers destroyed the House of Commons meeting room in 1941. So they now pack into the smaller debating chamber with its high ceilings and the boarded-up remains of the great stained glass windows that were shattered by the massive Luftwaffe bombardment. The 71-year-old Churchill is a creature of habit, rising each morning at 7:30 in his official residence at 10 Downing Street, just a half mile up the road from the Houses of Parliament. He works in bed until 11, whereupon he bathes, pours a weak Johnny Walker Red Scotch and water, then works some more. He sips Paul Rogers champagne with a lunch at 1 p.m. Whenever possible, this is followed by a game of backgammon with Clementine at 3:30. He then takes a 90-minute nap at 5 p.m. Arising, Churchill bathes a second time, works for an hour, eats a sumptuous dinner at 8 p.m., smokes a post-dinner cigar with a vintage Hein brandy. After that, he goes back to his study for more work until well past midnight. Unless he is traveling, this is how almost every day of Winston Churchill's life is structured, right down to the minute. But today there is a different feel. Tonight will be the last time German B-17s and British Lancasters will pound the German city of Dresden. Firebombs have already killed tens of thousands there. This was done with Churchill's full approval. 1 out of every 131 Londoners fell victim to German bombs. Thus, he has few moral qualms about punishing the German people. What makes today special for Churchill is that it marks a personal and political crossroads. He must mourn the death of a very good friend whose company he compares with the joy one gets in drinking a fine glass of champagne, while also reckoning with the fact that the same friend betrayed him and the British people. Conflicting emotions stir inside the Prime Minister as he begins his speech. When I became Prime Minister and the war broke out in all its hideous fury, when our own life and survival hung in the balance, I was already in a position to telegraph to the President on terms of an association which had become the most intimate and to me most agreeable. This continued through all the ups and downs of the world struggle until Thursday last, when I received my last messages from him, Churchill said. His voice is patrician and unmistakably English, and his tone is that of a professor lecturing a classroom, allowing his fellow MPs a glimpse into what was a long private relationship. One and all know that Churchill and Roosevelt were exceptionally close. What they do not know is that Roosevelt behaved very badly toward Churchill and England in the weeks leading up to his death. FDR was ineffectual in dealing with Joseph Stalin when the three met in the Black Sea resort of Yalta 2 months ago, allowing the Russians to dictate the future of post-war Europe at the expense of the British. It was Churchill who, during the early days of the war, relentlessly sought to build what he called the Grand Alliance among the three powers. To defeat Nazi Germany, he needed the industrial strength of the United States and the strategic power of Russia. But as time passed, Churchill was edged out of the alliance like an unwanted suitor. Thus, the British Empire, which has ruled the globe since the voyages of Captain James Cook in the 1700s, is no more. Much of the world will soon be ruled by the United States and Russia. Just as devastating to Churchill, a man who understands the powerful role symbolism plays in molding public opinion, the Americans are denying the British people their moment of glory. During the war, English cities have been bombed relentlessly and homes set ablaze. The British Commonwealth has seen 3 million casualties in the deserts of Africa, in the jungles of Borneo, in the fields of Europe, and in the skies over their beloved Britain. Between 1939 and 40, they stood with France against Nazi Germany. When France fell, England stood alone. It was Roosevelt and America who came to their rescue. There was never a moment's doubt, as the quarrel opened, upon which side his sympathies lay. The fall of France and what seemed to most people outside this island, the impending destruction of Great Britain, were to him an agony, although he never lost faith in us. Churchill now tells Parliament of the time FDR sent an emissary bearing a note written in his own hand. This letter contained the famous lines of Longfellow: "Sail on, O ship of state, sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all its hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. Roosevelt did more than supply inspirational verse. He also loaned Great Britain's ships, planes, and tanks, as well as trucks. The bearing of the British nation at the time of stress, when we were all alone, filled him in vast